I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, when did slavery actually end in this country? You can understand why most people would say with the conclusion of the Civil War, or most certainly the Emancipation Proclamation. But a new documentary based on an award-winning book describes how tens of thousands of black people were forced into slavery-like conditions for almost a century after the end of the war. We'll tell you about it in just a few minutes. But first, we want to turn to the political news that's shaping events in our time. Today, President Obama released his budget. Now, budgets are probably about as inspiring as watching paint dry, but in an election year, the budget can be both a rallying cry and a tangible list of policy priorities. Meanwhile, debate continues over President Obama's proposal to require most institutions that serve or employ the general public to offer health insurance plans that would include birth control. He offered a compromise last week, so we'll find out if that softened some of the criticism. And we'll ask how the race to select a Republican candidate to challenge President Obama is shaping up after the once and perhaps future frontrunner Mitt Romney scored two wins this weekend. Here to talk about these issues, Mary Kate Carey, columnist and blogger for U.S. News and World Report. She's also a former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush. Welcome back, Mary Kate. Thanks for joining
us. Great to be here again.
Also with us, Joy Ann Reed. She is the managing editor of the news site TheGrio.com and a frequent contributor to MSNBC. Joy, welcome back to you.
Great to be here.
So let's start off with the budget, Mary Kate. Big winners and losers in your view. I don't even know if that's an appropriate way to frame the question. I'm sorry.
Well, from the Republican point of view, I can tell you there's things that Republicans would like and not like in this budget. How's that? What they like is that the budget ends 12 different tax breaks for big corporations so that crony capitalism is addressed. There's $1 trillion in discretionary spending cuts over 10 years. Republicans like that. And most of all, at least the president proposed something, unlike the Senate Democrats who have not proposed anything since 2009, which I think is just unbelievable. Things that Republicans would not like in the president's budget are that there's $1.3 trillion in deficit spending in 2012 alone. They extend the unemployment benefits again, which I think is in danger of becoming a permanent entitlement. The payroll tax holiday gets extended, which I think is going to start having an effect on Medicare and Social Security because that's what funds it. There's not much on entitlement reform. There's absolutely no mention of Simpson-Bowles.
Which is a deficit reduction. It's a comprehensive deficit reduction plan. It was meant to attract bipartisan support.
Nothing on that.
Nothing on that.
And there was the fact sheet that came out from the White House might as well have come from the DNC. Very politically charged language, lots of stuff about progressivity, millionaires, the Buffett rule, lots of new investments. It's really sort of the more of the same. This is the fourth year now of $1 trillion deficit spending by the Obama administration. And I think it's feeding voter disgust and anger because they're not listening to what's going on. They're certainly not
on the Republican side. Anyway.
Yeah,
on the Republican side.
A lot of frustration.
Okay. Joanne, what do you pick up the thread here for you? And I just want to emphasize, I'm not making you the Democrat in this conversation, but I do want to ask what are the different perspectives about this? Because the argument on the progressive side has been that the president is going too far to placate his critics on the right who are not giving him anything in return. So, Joanne, give us another perspective on this, if you would.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think this is by nature a political document. Look, I mean, the reality is nothing's getting through this Congress. This has been an immobile Congress in a lot of ways. Just nothing can get through because to get through the House of Representatives, things have to be so far to the right that they're unworkable in the Senate. So this is really a statement of political priorities from the White House. And so in that, I think it actually is on the side of the majority of the American people. It talks about millionaires having to pay at least 30% in taxes, as do their secretaries, as do ordinary Americans. It talks about infrastructure spending, something that is on a bipartisan level very popular, the idea of getting people back to work in terms of construction, in terms of manufacturing, and really leaning into that idea of rebuilding America's roads, bridges, and tunnels and getting people back to work. So I think in that sense, it puts the president in the center of the political conversation because that's what people want. And it sort of amplifies the fairness argument that the president's going to be making in his reelection campaign that millionaires and billionaires should be paying the same percentage of taxes that ordinary Americans do.
You know, now House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, of course, the Republicans control the House, called it a, quote, completely political document. Would the White House dispute that characterization, Joanne?
Well, of course they will. But, of course, it is a political document. I mean, everything that's being done right now, whether it's from the Republicans or from the White House, is by nature political because we're in a reelection year.
And I want to ask Mary Kate about that because you were a speechwriter in the administration of President George H.W. Bush. Is it the expectation when you're in the White House that any budget presented in an election year is dead on arrival unless you control both houses of the Congress?
Yeah,
is that
I think
just
in the past that's
assumption?
Certainly been the pattern, which is a shame because I think people have kind of had it with that. And so, I think that's why Congress's approval ratings are 10%. And I think I saw Fidel Castro's was at 5%, so they're ahead of him.
Well, there you go. So nothing new here. If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Mary Kate Carey of U.S. News and World Report and Joy Ann Reed, managing editor of thegrio.com. That's an online news site. She's also a frequent contributor to MSNBC. We're talking some of the political news grabbing headlines this week. Here's a story that started, you know, actually last year and has continued. It seems to actually be building mm-hmm. in intensity. This is the issue around the president's regulations saying that institutions that serve the general public or employ large numbers of people of the general public or a general not sectarian institutions like churches and synagogues in their health insurance plans have to cover birth control. On Friday, the president announced a revision to the policy regarding coverage in response to the firestorm that he received from some religious leaders. And I'll play a short clip. This is White House Chief of Staff Jack Lew, who was on Meet the Press this weekend. Here it is.
We can say with certainty that women are going to have the right to health care. And we can say that religious institutions, including Catholic hospitals and universities, won't have to pay for or do the administrative work to provide benefits that they find objectionable. But that the women will get those benefits through the insurance companies that provide for their health care.
Now, Joanne, I'm going to ask you on this. Does the White House really think that this will placate people who have been critical, even bearing in mind that this is already the law in 28 states? So
right.
Does the White House really feel that this is going to throw water on this?
I honestly don't think that the White House's goal was to necessarily placate the bishops. And the reason I say that is because the bishops are on record going back to lawsuits they've been filing since 2002 of wanting to ban birth control. You know, they actually said in 2010, well, women could just abstain, that they just don't like the idea of birth control being offered, particularly for free, to women. This despite the fact that something like 98% of women are in favor of having control over their own fertility. You know, I think the White House, in a way, has walked into kind of a genius move here. They've gotten the right to say on record that they oppose birth control. And they've gotten women to hear out of the president's own mouth that the president is going to stand behind women controlling their own fertility. Women want to have the same access to birth control that men have to Viagra, let's say. And I think that it's only fair. So I think the White House is in a good position with the people that really they need to be in the lens looking at for the reelection, which is women, particularly younger women, and just women in general, because I think the bishops are way out of the mainstream on this.
Mary Kate, give us your perspective on this. You are a practicing Catholic,
if
you don't mind. And you've told us this, so we're not giving your personal
business
here. We're not outing you. What's your perspective on this?
My feeling is that this is not a fight about birth control. Catholic women have been figuring out how to get birth control for decades now. So that's not what this is about. And I think that it reminded me, I was joking around earlier about it, that this is like the difference last night at the Grammys between Record of the Year and Song of the Year, in that everybody looks at it and says, wait, what's the difference? All the same songs are still getting nominated for both categories. And so that's what this is. This is the same song as it was last Thursday, as it is today.
But talk about, if you would, about, you said that you think this is a wedge issue. And the reason that I think we continue to ask about this is that the polls show that a majority mm-hmm. of Catholic voters, when surveyed on this particular question, have said to this point that they think health insurance should cover contraception, despite what the bishops think. A narrow majority.
Still think
so tell me why you think this is still a wedge issue that Republican candidates are going to use in this election.
Catholics like me are sticking with the Catholic Church throughout the pedophile scandal and all of this craziness because we believe in the social justice mission of the church. And we believe all the good that Catholic charities and all these adoption agencies and all the hospitals and universities do. And nothing has changed for those people since Friday. Those people who run those institutions, all the women who work for them, are still included in a nationwide mandate that includes the morning after pill. And most Catholics do not think the morning after pill is contraception. And it still is about religious liberty. It still defines those community service organizations as non-exempt. And it's still they're still facing fines if they don't provide these health care plans, even if it's for free.
But even though the administration's revision says that that the insurance companies would provide this coverage directly, and that in essence you would
It's like a workaround.
Right. That you would go directly to the insurance company as opposed and bypass the institution.
But Catholic Charities, one of the ones we talked about last week, Catholic Charities is self-insured. Like, that doesn't solve the problem for them. And so I think it's sort of a cynical move. The speed with which it was rushed out last Friday, it just doesn't seem very thoughtful to me. And I think people on the right don't think their considerations got taken
Joanne?
I would say that the problem there is that this highlights a very simple fact. That let's say at Catholic Charities, the Catholic Church wants to be able to tell its female employees, you can't have birth control. And they want the government to sanction essentially a religious argument that women should not be able to control their own fertility. This is a women's liberty issue. And I think that when you highlight the fact that the Catholic Church wants to be able to tell employees, even of its institutions like hospitals and schools, not the church itself, but the hospitals and schools, women, you can't have birth control, and we want to be able to.
I don't think they're arguing that. I think they're saying you can't have it for free on our dime.
That's been the substance of their argument.
Well, so this is where the issue is framed as religious liberty versus women's rights versus
the right
to pay. So obviously the argument continues because the two of you disagree about how this should be framed.
I think it's religious liberty, and she thinks it's contraception.
That's what explains then why this is an ongoing issue. It's
going
to keep going. Unfortunately, we don't have time to talk about Mitt Romney, but. Sure enough, surely the race continues. We'll talk about it in the future, I'm sure. Joanne Reed is the managing editor of thegrio.com and a contributor to MSNBC. She joined us from her office in New York. Mary Kate Carey is a columnist and blogger for U.S. News and World Report, also a former presidential speechwriter in the administration of President George H.W. Bush. She was here in Washington, D.C. Ladies, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we'll remember Whitney Houston with two people who knew her well, music writer Stephen Ivory and the president of BET, Deborah Lee. That's coming up later. But first, as most people know, this is Black History Month, and this is a time when many people reacquaint themselves with the history of people of African descent in America. History which is often presented as a clear narrative line, which starts in slavery and ends in freedom, a freedom which was largely achieved with the Civil War and perfected, let's say, through the Civil Rights Movement. But now there's a new film that adds significant complication to that smooth arc of a story. The film is called Slavery by Another Name. It premieres tonight on PBS, although you might want to check your local listings for exact times. It's based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning book of the same title, and it explores exactly what it says, how countless Black Southerners fell victim to a brutal system of forced labor long past the Emancipation Proclamation. It also describes how that system sought to justify itself in part through the Constitution.
When you go to the 13th Amendment, one of the fascinating things about the text of that amendment is that it says that slavery is abolished except in the case of a punishment for a crime. And within that wiggle room, there's still the possibility of extending slavery, as it were, by another name.
That was Adam Green, one of the historians featured in the film, Slavery by Another Name. And joining us now is the director of the film, Emmy Award winner Sam Pollard. Also with us, Douglas Blackman, the author of the book and co-executive producer of the film. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Doug Blackman, I'm going to start with you because you talked about growing up in Mississippi. I've seen you talk about this in previous interviews. And the history that you were taught did not include this. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would.
I grew up in a cotton town in which there were more Black people than white, and I attended public schools there during the desegregation time when the schools became overwhelmingly Black. I was interested in and motivated around why were things as crazy as they were in those early years of my childhood. There was this story always that after the Civil War, the freed slaves had been sort of ill-equipped for freedom had been inclined to lawlessness, and that was the justification for why the White South had moved so aggressively to resubjugate African Americans. And in the course of the research for the book and the film, I really came to realize that that's just fundamentally a false story.
I like the word crazy that you use, the crazy things that were happening. Could you just give us an example? I'm speaking specifically just some of these laws that essentially criminalized black life.
The intention of the White South in the late 19th century and early 20th century was to pass laws which effectively criminalized black life. And so it was illegal in the South for a black man to walk beside a railroad, to speak loudly in the company of a white woman. But the most insidious laws, and there were all sorts of these things, was that, number one, it was a crime if you couldn't prove you were employed at any given moment. You could be declared a vagrant, and once declared a vagrant, you had tremendous legal vulnerability and could easily end up being sold into a form of forced labor. And the other terribly, terribly damaging law was that it was a crime in the South for any farm worker, though the law was really only ever applied to black people, to seek employment from a new employer without permission from the person you worked for at the time. And so it was a crime to look for a job in the South, no matter how badly abused you were at the hands of whoever employed you at the time. And those laws resulted in thousands and thousands and thousands of arrests of African Americans on the most specious ground.
Sam Pollard, I'm going to ask you this. Now, you've done, as an adult, many films about the story of African Americans in the U.S., and I was curious to know whether this was something that you knew about growing up.
Growing up in East Harlem, but having parents who both came from the South, Mississippi and Georgia, you know, we heard lots of stories growing up from my father and my mother and my uncles and my aunts and my grandfather, but we never heard that story. So when I heard about Doug's book, which was in galleys originally, it was like really surprising.
Sam Pollard, you drew on the letters that Mr. Blackman found to write his book to create reenactments for the film. I just want to listen to one of them. This is an actor. He's playing Ezekiel Archie. He was a convict. He sent letters from a coal mine in Alabama. And in this one, he's describing his life in the mine and how workers were treated by their boss, somebody named J.W. Comer.
Worked hungry, thirsty, half-clothed, and sore. That Comer's a hard man. I seen him hit men 100 and 160 times with a 10-prong strap.
Sam Pollard, the film makes use not of the letters, but there are still photographs of people in just horrific circumstances. There's one I cannot get out of my head, which is it looks like it could be a teenager or a young boy who's literally staked to the ground. It's fairly shocking. I mean, it's very shocking stuff here. And I wanted to ask how you decided what to include and what to leave out. I mean, some of this is very graphic material and going to be very hard for some people to take.
Yeah, we know that. But, you know, when we were doing the research, and Doug had done a lot of this research when he was putting together the book, so we were able to cull from his archive some of these stills. And then we had an archivist who also dug deeper. We know they're going to be tough, but I think it's important for people to understand the horrors of what people had to suffer through during that period of time.
Doug Blackman, could you talk a little bit more about that? What were some of the ways that people were kept in these conditions?
Well, once a person had been sold into these forced labor camps or the forced labor coal mines, there was almost no protection of any kind in terms of government supervision to be certain that they were properly fed or that they received any sort of health care. And so what happened again and again is that people were worked to the very limits of human endurance. In many of these camps, the people who ran them or the sheriffs who would arrest them originally would be paid a fee that would be taken from the prisoner. The prisoner had to end up paying the sheriff who had arrested them for the cost of their arrest. The sheriffs would be provided with a certain amount of money from the state to feed prisoners, but the incentive to them was to feed them as little as possible and keep as much of the feeding money as possible. And the mortality rates from some of these work camps were as much as 30 and 40% a year.
We're talking about the new documentary, Slavery by Another Name. It's based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning book of the same title. The film premieres on PBS tonight, although you want to check your local listings for exact times. We're joined by director Sam Pollard and the author and co-executive producer Douglas Blackman. We hear in the film, Sam Pollard, from descendants of people on both sides, those who worked in the forced labor system and the people who ran the system, including Georgia farmer John Williams. He had several black men working on his farm under horrible conditions. And then when he came under legal suspicion in 1921, he decided that the only way to escape prosecution was to, quote, do away with these boys, unquote. And he and an accomplice killed 11 of them. And there's an interview with his great-granddaughter, Susan Bernor, talking about discovering that history. I'll just play that short clip. Here it is.
They did it in the most horrific ways that you can imagine, that I really can't talk about. I just get so emotional when I think about not just the fact that these men were murdered, but the cruelty with which it was carried out. That's what's hardest for me to imagine and hardest to accept.
This can't be the only person who knows about this. And yet this history seems to have been, well, it can't have been all but obliterated. I mean, clearly these documents existed. The fact is, Mr. Blackman, you're able to reconstruct this. But I'm just wondering why each of you thinks this isn't better known. And Mr. Blackman, I'll start with you.
For white Americans, there was no shame in any of this. At the time, people knew about it and they talked about it. The next generations of white Americans didn't particularly want to talk about this, recognized that there was something problematic about it, and it slipped beyond living memory. For African Americans, there was an awareness decades ago that it might be dangerous to pass on certain stories about certain injuries to your children or your grandsons, that encouraging anger on their part could be a risky thing, as we saw happen to many African Americans. And so there really was this kind of inadvertent conspiracy of silence that occurred on both sides of the racial divide.
Hmm. Sam Pollard, what's your thought about that?
Many of these men were considered criminals, and sometimes when you're a criminal, you're kind of like pushed out of the limelight. Then sometimes, as black people, you know, your parents and your great-grandparents and your uncles and aunts didn't want to talk about the things that were hard in a way to protect us from what we might have to deal with, you know, particularly when I went down south to visit aunts and uncles.
Douglas Blackman, why did this system persist as long as it did?
It continued because it was economically imperative to the South and to America. After the Civil War, the white South simply could not resurrect the cotton economy. And the only way that the South was ultimately able to do that was to find a way to resubjugate an enormous population of people. And it only began to break down in the 1940s when a combination of two things. The Federal Department of Justice takes a committed position to say, when we learn of cases of involuntary servitude in the South, we're going to investigate and prosecute. It made a big difference. And at the same time, the mechanical cotton picker was invented in the 1940s, chemicals that could kill weeds instead of having to chop them by hoe with a hand. And so the need for these armies of laborers began to diminish, and those two factors are what led to the authentic end of the system ultimately.
Sam Pollard, a final question of you. Why do you think it is important to pass on these stories now?
It's really vital to understand this aspect of the history that people don't know about. Because if you understand that, then maybe you'll look at things differently. And one of the things that I think is courageous about this film that we've done is this two white women whose families were involved in this involuntary servitude who have the courage to sit down in front of us on camera and open up about their reactions to what they had read in Doug's book and what it means to them to understand the truth now about their ancestors. That, to me, was one of the most important things I think I've ever done as a filmmaker.
Sam Pollard is the award-winning director of the film Slavery by Another Name. He joined us from our bureau in New York. Douglas Blackman is the co-executive producer of the documentary. It's based on his book of the same title, and he joined us from Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. The film premieres on PBS tonight. You'll want to check your local listings for exact times. Gentlemen, I thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
On a much lighter note, did you know that one of the oldest sporting events in U.S. history has been held long before the Super Bowl, the World Series, before March Madness, even before the automobile was invented. It is the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show, and today marks the beginning of the 136th annual event held in New York. And there's a new dog in town, previously known as the Mexican Hairless Dog, and it will make its debut at this year's show. Joining us to tell us more is Amy Fernandez. She breeds this, well, breed. She has two of them at home. She's covering this year's Westminster Dog Show for Dog World Magazine, and she's with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Now, I'm afraid to pronounce the dog's name. I'm afraid I'm going to mess it up, so help me out. What's it called?
Okay, well, I got this from a cab driver in Mexico City. I know exactly how to pronounce it. Xolo Eats Quintly. It's an Aztec Indian word.
Xolo Eats Quintly.
Mm-hmm.
But we can call him Xolo for short.
Oh, yeah. Everybody just opts for Xolo. It's much safer.
And describe the breed for us, if you would.
We call it a primitive breed, meaning that it was molded by natural selection. Most breeds, you think of them in terms of artificial selection and dog breeding. This breed, it's graceful, it's athletic, and the most important thing is it's hairless.
It's hairless, although some have a little kind of like a mohawk.
Yeah, they have a few hairs on the top of the head, on the toes, and the tail tip. That's normal. And there's two varieties. They can come with hair and without.
And I understand the Xolo comes in toy, miniature, and standard, like a number of other breeds. Do I have that
right?
That's
right, yes. You have three sizes. The toys range up to 13 inches. The miniatures up to 18. And the standards are big. They're 23 inches, about the size of Doberman.
How did you fall in love with this breed?
I was showing Cresteds at rare breed shows way, way before they were recognized, and this was the only other hairless breed that I would see at the show. So naturally, you're curious and you get interested, and the breed had almost no following then. It was really just about dying out in this country. There was no organized club. There was nobody really keeping it on track and trying to make an effort to get it back into AKC, and it had been AKC recognized once.
And by AKC, you mean the American Kennel Club?
Yes.
Which is the kind of official body that recognizes breeds and, I guess, sets standards for
dogs. The club set the standards, but it's the official registry for this country.
You've been advocating for the breed to be included in the Westminster for a long time now. Why, and why is that important?
Well, unless you have AKC recognition, it really makes a difference in terms of keeping the breed on track. It gives you a platform to advocate for the breed and protect the breed. You have to keep the breeders in touch with each other, especially if it's a really rare breed. They have to be able to find each other and work together to promote the breed and continue healthy breeding programs. The breed could die out otherwise.
Tell me a little bit about the personality of the Xolo, if you would. I mean, is it mainly a looks thing with you? You kind of like how they look, or do they have a nice personality? Are they fun?
Well, it's a real dog kind of a dog. They're survivalists. They have very keen senses, very keen instincts. They're hunters. They look out for themselves, and they bond very closely to their owners because this is one of the first things that, I mean, this is the thing that set the wolves and the dogs apart. They begin bonding with humans. That partnership is what kept both species ahead of the game for thousands of years, so Xolos really tune into their owners. They're very, very devoted dogs.
You know, the hairless thing would be kind of a stop for some people. Kind of petting the dog is kind of part of the fun for some people. And that implies fur for a lot of us. I don't know. So is the hairless thing, or is it a thing of, forgive me, I know some people hate this expression, but are they so like ugly they're cute?
Nobody's neutral. Nobody warms up to them later. You either love them on sight or you just don't want anything to do with them. But
so I understand, finally, but before we let you go, and thank you for coming over from the show because I know it's a busy time. I understand that Best in Show will be picked tomorrow. And it seems that terriers or spaniels have been favored in recent years. Might we see a Xolo upset this year, or you think it's a little too soon for that?
I mean, this is traditionally the show of upsets, and the top winning dog of the year goes into this with a big chance and very rarely wins. So, hey, anything can happen.
Well, best of luck anyway.
Thank you.
Amy Fernandez is a Xolo Eats Quintly expert. She is the author of several dog books. She's covering this year's Westminster Dog Show for Dog World magazine. And she was kind enough to join us today from our bureau in New York. Amy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, a diva finally gets her due. We talk about singer Diana Ross, who was honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammys yesterday. We'll talk more about that in just a minute. But as most people now know, Sunday's Grammys were sadly somewhat overshadowed by the sudden death of superstar Whitney Houston. She was just 48 years old. Here's host LL Cool J offering a prayer for Houston at the start of last night's ceremony.
Heavenly Father, we thank you for sharing our sister Whitney with us. Today our thoughts are with her mother, her daughter, and all of her loved ones. And although she is gone too soon, we remain truly blessed to have been touched by her beautiful spirit and to have her lasting legacy of music to cherish and share forever. Amen.
We wanted to talk more about Whitney Houston's life and legacy, so we've called longtime culture critic and music journalist Stephen Ivory. We also hope to have with us Deborah Lee, the chairman and CEO of BET Networks. BET honored Whitney Houston just 2 years ago. Stephen Ivory, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's a very difficult period, and many people are very shocked and upset by this, as I know you are as well. But I'd like to ask you to focus on what made Whitney Houston so special as an artist.
What made Whitney Houston special was the fact that she was one of the few vocalists who could go seamlessly between R&B and pop and jazz. She could actually sing jazz. People didn't hear her sing a lot of it, but she could sing jazz. But this was a woman whose godmother was Aretha Franklin, who is the embodiment of soul vocalizing. And her cousin, Dionne Warwick, spent all of those years making great modern pop records with Burt Bacharach. All of that has to be influential to this woman at some point. But it was her instincts as a vocalist that made her just above par.
Deborah Lee is now with us. She is the chair and CEO of BET Networks. The BET is hosting the BET Honors tonight, and Whitney Houston was honored by your organization in 2010. Deborah Lee, tell us a little bit more about why you chose to recognize her in that way, and what made her so special as an artist in your view?
Oh, well, hi, Michelle. Whitney was such a great talent, and she had always been a great friend of BET. We were instrumental in breaking her, you know, when her career first started. We honored her with our second Walk of Fame many years ago. She got the Lifetime Achievement at our first BET Awards. And as you said, in 2010, we honored her at BET Honors. And it was such a great way to recognize her long career, her talent, everything she gave us. I mean, she really was the voice of our generation. And she was such a great person, so giving. We aired the 2010 Honors yesterday, and just seeing her reaction to Kim Burrell and Jennifer Hudson, who both paid tribute to her that night. And it was one of the first time people had seen Whitney in a couple of years. So everyone was rooting for her. You know, she had numerous comebacks. I went to her album release party several years ago with her last album. And every year we look forward to seeing her at Clive Davis's party. And to be there this year, knowing that she had passed away, was just so surreal and so sad. But I'm glad the tribute last night on the Grammys was terrific. LL saying the prayer for her was really touching. And, you know, she will be missed.
Well, I wanted to ask more about that because we reached out on, of course, Twitter and Facebook and asked our listeners to comment on what it is about her that made her special to them. I just want to read one of them. Trevor Fanning said, "For me, it's that at every point in my life, there's been a Whitney song to go along with it. I was excited for every album she released, no matter type of venue, music video, film, as a musical guest on SNL, or the unbeatable and never-to-be-matched Star-Spangled Banner. She brought something new and amazing to her singing and the song." Stephen, I'm going to go back to you and ask, what is it about her that made people feel that they had a personal connection? Do you have any sense of why?
Well, it was her ability to deliver a song. I mean, the songs that she sang were very emotional songs, had to do with love affair and relationships. And she had the uncanny ability to deliver the sentiment of these songs in such an instinctive way.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the life and legacy of music legend Whitney Houston. I'm speaking with journalist Stephen Ivory, that's who was speaking just now, and also with us Deborah Lee, the chair and CEO of BET Networks. Deborah, this is a little bit painful to think about, but there were people who criticized her at some point in her earlier history. They said that she was too, some African-American audiences, for example, felt that she was a crossover star, but they felt she'd crossed over a little too far, that they felt that she'd kind of lost something authentic in her music. Do you have any sense of whether that bothered her, that kind of criticism bothered her at all?
I don't think so. I mean, Whitney was very self-assured. You know, she came from a long legacy of musical greats with her mother, Sissy, and her aunt, Dionne Warwick. I think, you know, she was trying to find her own way and try to find her own voice. I think she was always embraced by the Black community, whether she was singing pop or gospel, you know, in her movie career. I mean, I don't think she had that much criticism. You know, a couple of her songs were pop, and she did cross over. But I think we always felt she was a part of our community and, you know, always remembered her roots, her church roots, and her connection to our community. As I said, she was a big supporter of BET. She always showed up anytime we asked her. And, you know, she kept that connect. So I don't think she was one of those kind of artists where you worried about her remembering where she came from. I mean, she was true to herself. She just had a great outsized talent. And I think she wanted to share it with the world. And, you know, looking back, it's so great that everyone embraced her and that she had a crossover career. I mean, I really, you know, music is such a wonderful thing. And I think the Grammys and Clive Davis's party the other night really were evidence of that. It brings people together. It makes you feel good, even in troubled times. And I think Whitney was such a great example of that. As someone mentioned, her Star Spangled Banner appearance. I mean, that was for everyone. And that's the kind of artist she was from the very beginning of her career.
Stephen Ivory, we asked you to select a couple of songs that you thought would be really exemplify her artistry and skill. What would you like us to play? How about The Greatest Love of All? Would that be the one? Or would it be You Give Good Love as an example of what it is that was so special about her talent?
Well, I mean, you know, we could go on forever, but those are two great songs that exemplify her style and her ability to deliver a song.
Well, then let's do The Greatest Love of All. You know, that doesn't begin to do justice to her amazing range and skill and articulation and all that. Deborah Lee, though, I do want to ask you, you have the opportunity to work with and observe many young artists. And I just wanted to ask, is there a cautionary tale to Whitney Houston's story that you would like young artists, the young artists that you work with, to learn from this? If there's something that we should all learn from her example?
Well, I think the caution is that people need to understand that our stars, our artists, our musical legends are people also. You know, they have to reconcile their public persona and their trials and tribulations as people, whether it's family issues or dealing with your career. I saw Quincy Jones on TV this morning talking about why musical artists sometimes are have difficulty. But you have to have this public persona, but you have to deal with them as a person, and we can't ask too much for them. And I think sometimes we do. We put them on a pedestal, and we think they don't have issues, but they do.
But they do.
Whitney was human.
And on that note, we have to leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us to talk about the legacy of this important artist. Deborah Lee is the chairman and CEO of BET. That's Black Entertainment Television. She was with us by phone from Los Angeles. Also with us, Stephen Ivory, journalist who covers music and culture. He was with us from NPR West. Thank you both.
Thank you.
One of the Facebook comments we received about Whitney Houston yesterday was from Ashi White, who called her my generation's Diana Ross. Ross herself got her due at the Grammys yesterday when she was honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award. It was her first Grammy win, even though she has scored a dozen nominations across decades for songs like Upside Down, Touch Me in the Morning, and the Supremes' hit Baby Love. Ross first came to fame as one of the Supremes, originally called the Primettes, when they first got together in Detroit in 1959. Their combination of high fashion and sweet vocals became the blueprint for successful girl groups for decades. Ross left the group to pursue a solo career in 1970. Fans around the world fell in love with her music and her style, but she didn't always inspire warm feelings. The 1991 book Call Her Miss Ross painted an unflattering portrait. And later, former Supreme Mary Wilson spoke out bitterly about her view that Ross unfairly claimed undue credit for the group's success. But others insisted Diana Ross won the spotlight because she was willing to fight for it. Her frequent recording partner Marvin Gaye was quoted this way in the biography Divided Soul, The Life of Marvin Gaye, quote, "She'll out-rehearse you, out-dress you, and out-perform you, so you best stay out of her way," unquote. And in fact, here are Marvin Gaye and Diana Ross together in the song You Are Everything.
As he turned the corner,
Ross found success far beyond the recording studio. She became an icon of black beauty at a time when African-American women often could not see themselves on fashion runways or magazine covers. She made the leap to the big screen in films like Mahogany and in her Oscar-nominated performance as Billie Holiday in Lady Sings the Blues.
She feels so sad. Wants the world to know.
In point of fact, the Grammys are a little late to the party when it comes to honoring Ross. She has her own star on Hollywood's Walk of Fame. She won a Tony for her one-woman show, An Evening with Diana Ross, and was recognized as a living treasure of American arts at the Kennedy Center Honors. And beyond the prizes and statues, every time the ladies of American R&B strut across the stage in a fabulous gown to belt out a hit song, they're walking in her footsteps. Now it's time for the occasional segment we call In Your Ear. That's where we ask some of our guests what they're listening to these days. Today we're going to hear some music that inspires Roscoe Brown. During World War II, he served with the Tuskegee Airmen, America's first black fighter pilots. We spoke with him earlier this year when the movie Red Tails was released. Red Tails was based on the story of the Tuskegee Airmen. And here are some of the songs he listens to.
I'm Dr. Roscoe Brown, Tuskegee Airman. I come from the generation where we listened to good jazz music. And I'm from New York, and probably my most favorite song is Take the A-Train by Duke Ellington, because I used to ride the A-Train from 145th Street down to West 4th Street where I was going to school at NYU.
I used to visit all the very gay places, those come what may places, where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life.
On my iPhone, I have John Coltrane and Johnny Hartman, who was a friend of mine, singing Lush Life.
Life is lonely again, and only last year everything seemed so sure.
At that's right on my cell phone, and whenever I want to cool out, I listen to that, because Johnny Hartman had that beautiful voice and that tenor of John Coltrane right behind it.
I'll live a lush life in some small dive, and there I'll be while I rot with the rest of those whose lives are lonely too.
Unforgettable. My third song is Unforgettable, the one with Nat Cole and his daughter, Natalie Cole. It goes back in the days when I first got married, and that was one of my favorite songs. And then when Natalie picks it up around the 90s and does that cut in there, it's really a beautiful, heartwarming song. And that's the kind of music I like to listen to, and it always brings me good feelings.
That's how you'll stay. That's why, darling, it's incredible that someone so unforgettable thinks that I am unforgettable too.
That was former Tuskegee Airman Roscoe Brown telling us what's playing in his ear. To hear our previous conversation with him, please go to our website. Go to NPR.org. Click on the Programs tab and then on Tell Me More. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
Unforgettable.
Unforgettable.
In every way.
In every way. Forevermore.
That's how you'll stay.
That's how you'll stay.
That's why, darling, it's incredible that someone so unforgettable thinks that I am unforgettable too.